Hi, I'm Sophie, and this is Age Well with Dr. Sophie Schotter, a space devoted to all things health, wellness, and longevity. Because for me, aging well is about looking and feeling like the best possible version of ourselves, inside as well as out. So together with my producer, Fee, I'll be deep diving into the latest research, sifting fact from fiction. I'll also be talking to all kinds of trusted experts, tapping into their knowledge, along with bringing you conversations from a range of interesting women and men, finding out how they age well. So, this is my show. Welcome along. And as always, thank you so much for listening.
Well, Sophie, there's a lot of interesting stuff to talk about with the thyroid, but we're also talking about iodine. So let's talk about iodine first of all. What is iodine?
So iodine is a mineral that the body needs and the body stores, but the body can't make it for itself. And we need iodine to make two thyroid hormones, thyroxine and triiodothyronine. So if you know a little about thyroid hormones, these are T4 and T3. Mm-hmm. Iodine deficiency is actually a global issue. The World Health Organization has estimated that over 1.9 billion people worldwide have inadequate iodine nutrition, which gives you a clue in terms of how we can get it or get more of it. And that's through diet, which, as I'll explain, is much better than supplements unless you have a really serious deficiency. Iodine is found in the soil and in the ocean and in certain cereals, grains and vegetables. But the most reliable source seems to be fish and shellfish. Dairy is also a pretty good way of getting it. Iodine supplements tend to be used for iodine deficiency, which I have to add is quite rare, and also for various thyroid conditions. But while iodine is important, we need very little of it because it's a micronutrient. Too much could actually cause problems or make existing issues worse.
That's what I've been reading. Can we talk more about the link between the thyroid and iodine?
So I guess a little explainer, because a lot of people aren't sure. Your thyroid gland is a butterfly-shaped gland that sits at the front of your neck. So if you have hypothyroidism, this gland doesn't make enough thyroid hormones. And if you have hyperthyroidism, it's overactive and makes too much. And just to flag up some of the symptoms, because there's a lot of signs and problems in the body that could be linked to thyroid issues. But some of these issues can also be related to other things. So we need to look at kind of the complete picture. We're talking weight gain with hypothyroidism, weight loss with hyperthyroidism, hair loss with either. Fatigue is really common with hypothyroidism, and we can be almost manic and over-energized with hyperthyroidism. Brain fog, cold hands and feet, again, really common with hypothyroidism. Brittle nails, dry skin, again, hypothyroidism. Restless legs, insomnia, depression. Floaters in your eyes, muscle weakness, dizziness, tingles and numbness, ringing or buzzing in the ear. And again, these symptoms can also be indicative of other problems. So perimenopause is another one, and it can all get quite confusing. The main and most common cause of an underactive thyroid, so this is hypothyroidism, is an autoimmune condition called Hashimoto's thyroid disease. And this is where your immune system attacks your thyroid gland, meaning it can't make enough thyroid hormone. Hashimoto's is most common in women and usually starts somewhere between the ages of 30 and 50. But anyone can get an underactive thyroid. It can also be caused by other things such as iodine deficiency, though medics do believe that in most people there is an underlying autoimmune condition. And there are many reasons why your thyroid can be overactive. So this is hyperthyroidism. The main one is an autoimmune condition called Graves' disease, where the immune system produces antibodies that cause the thyroid to produce too much thyroid hormone. And about 4 in every 5 people with an overactive thyroid have Graves' disease. Mm-hmm. And as I said, iodine is critical for the correct function of our thyroid gland, and it's needed to make these thyroid hormones, which then regulate our metabolism. If we don't have enough iodine in our diet, it can cause the thyroid to work harder to try to keep the right amount of thyroid hormones in the blood. And it also means the thyroid gland might increase in size in an attempt to hold on to and trap as much iodine as it can. And this can lead to a swelling in the front of the neck, which is known as a goiter. In the UK, iodine deficiency is a public health concern, particularly amongst vegetarians and vegans, both of whom don't eat fish, and in the case of vegans, don't eat dairy either. So again, iodine's primary function is to produce these thyroid hormones, and these not only regulate metabolism, they also play a vital role in brain development, particularly during pregnancy and early childhood. So iodine is a key consideration for pregnant women. In fact, a few years back, The Lancet published a paper that said a lack of iodine can lead to reduced mental development in children with a direct effect on fetal brain development. So to recap, the body absolutely needs iodine because without it, you can't make thyroid hormones, and pregnant women should absolutely ensure adequate iodine intake. Mm-hmm. To go a bit deeper, our thyroid hormone levels are controlled by another hormone, the thyroid stimulating hormone, or TSH. And if thyroid hormones are low, the brain releases TSH to tell your thyroid gland to make more thyroid hormones. Going back to the two different types of disorders, primary hypothyroidism means that the thyroid is receiving enough TSH, but doesn't release enough of the actual thyroid hormones, whereas secondary hypothyroidism, which is a lot less common, is where the thyroid doesn't get enough TSH. I do have to say, though, that there is disagreement out there on what causes many thyroid issues, and a lot of people also feel that conventional NHS thyroid testing isn't entirely accurate, and therefore, if the results come back normal, you could still be suffering with an under- or overactive thyroid gland. I'll run through some of the newer thinking shortly.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for explaining that and actually explaining what some of these hormones are, because I'd heard of them but hadn't quite related them from the acronym to what the actual hormones are. Let's go back to iodine deficiency in a moment. Just to stay on the thyroid as we're there, what is the usual NHS route for either an under or an overactive thyroid?
Okay, so let's start with hypothyroidism, underactive. So common symptoms include feeling extremely tired, feeling more cold than usual, putting on weight, constipation, difficulty thinking or thinking clearly, low mood or depression, dry skin, dry hair, sometimes even hair loss, a croaky voice, and irregular or heavy periods if you have them. And symptoms usually develop slowly and get worse with time. If a GP thinks you might have an underactive thyroid, they'll ask about your symptoms and will probably check how much thyroid stimulating hormone, TSH, is in your blood. It's quite rare that they actually check your T4 level. So in an underactive thyroid, you will normally have a high level of TSH. Generally, it's treated with a drug to replace the thyroid hormone that your body can't produce, usually levothyroxine tablets, and these can typically be taken for life. With hyperthyroidism, an overactive thyroid, again, a huge range of symptoms: anxiety, mood swings, difficulty sleeping, persistent tiredness or feeling weak, sensitivity to heat, swelling in your neck, palpitations, and twitching or trembling. Your GP might order blood tests to check how well your thyroid is working, and if the blood tests show that you have an overactive thyroid, you might be referred for further tests to identify the cause. Usually an overactive thyroid is treatable in one of three ways. So first would be drugs that stop your thyroid producing too much of the hormone. So this is carbimazole. Or radioiodine treatment, where a type of radiotherapy is used to destroy cells in the thyroid, and that reduces its ability to produce thyroid hormones. And surgery to remove some or all of your thyroid is also an option, so that it no longer produces thyroid hormones. For the latter two options of those, many people end up actually having to also then take thyroid hormones. Mm-hmm. Each of these treatments does have benefits and drawbacks, and so it's something to talk through with your GP or specialist.
Okay, and so to flip the conversation, what are these so-called alternatives?
So to give you an idea of where I've been looking, there's a lot of functional doctors and patients-turned-influencers who talk a lot about the role of diet and lifestyle. I'll skate over the basics and name-check a few of these people, as there's not enough time to deep dive into all of this. There's Dr. Alicia Nicely, who says she overcame Hashimoto's and hypothyroidism. Dr. Katie Rothwell, who did the same thing and has now launched something called the Thyroid Academy. Dr. Rachel Vong, Dr. Robin Urikar, Aggie McKay, Priscilla Blevins. Many people out there are very active on socials and talk about their personal experience. And I'll link into all of this in the show notes. The natural approach is predicated on diet and supplements, and naturopathic doctors will also tend to look out for other things going on in the body, so any gut and digestive issues or any viral infections. They'll probably talk a lot about iodine and the amino acid tyrosine as important nutrients for your T4 hormone, thyroxine, to be produced. This tends to mean a high protein diet, so keto is often a watchword in the natural approach. If you're a vegetarian, this can mean a lot of eggs, dairy, nuts and beans, and Brazil nuts and pumpkin seeds are two really useful ones. Several herbs are also said to support thyroid function, and these include ashwagandha, bladderwrack, bugleweed and lemon balm. But I would also say always seek advice from an expert, as these herbs can be extremely potent and potentially toxic in too high a dose. Kelp supplements, for example, apparently contain excessive levels of iodine, and too much is not a good thing either. The top mineral for thyroid health is probably selenium, but again, speak to an expert, as overdoing selenium supplements can lead to hypothyroid-like symptoms, and then it can be difficult to decipher between this and hypothyroidism. Other micronutrients that support the thyroid include zinc and magnesium. Iron is also a key factor, as it helps to transport thyroid hormones, and sometimes iron deficiency is the root of hypothyroid-like symptoms. All of these nutrients can be tested to see if supplementation is needed. Back to iodine supplements, and I just want to stress that it's not recommended to take these unless recommended by a healthcare professional, because in the event of Hashimoto's thyroiditis, too much iodine might trigger a flare. But in terms of taking a natural approach, lifestyle does seem to make a difference. Paying attention to lowering stress, exercising, good sleep hygiene, these all help. The stress hormone cortisol actually impacts thyroid health quite intricately. If we have too much cortisol, i.e. we're highly stressed, the body will slow down the thyroid conversion of T4 into T3, which is an important step in its activity. Exercise can actually help promote an increase in both T4 and T3 levels, and this has been proven in many studies now. For those with hypothyroidism, this should be a part of a well-balanced program, but sometimes is introduced after hormone levels start to increase so that the energy is there to be used up with exercise. And in case of hyperthyroidism, low-impact exercise might be suggested. But one thing I really do want to stress is that at both extremes, hypo and hyperthyroidism can even be life-threatening. And so the important thing is to follow medical advice. These sorts of diet and lifestyle approaches can be incredible in many, many people, but think of it as part of a bigger treatment plan. Don't think that when you're in an extreme condition that starting with these is going to be the fix. It may be you need medication and medical support.
Yeah, and even some of these influences, I think, would concur and agree with that. And if they don't, then I'm sure that you wouldn't approve of just ditching medication. Mm-mm. Does the menopause impact thyroid function?
Yes, absolutely. Hypothyroidism, or the underactive, can worsen during perimenopause. And a lot of the symptoms could also feel similar to perimenopause symptoms. But some of the more unusual ones are a loss of physical strength. And this is actually a sign that you might be deficient in iodine, this feeling of being weak. A study from the Journal of Dermatoendocrinology also shows that depleted levels of the thyroid hormones can impact the epidermal barrier function, which helps your skin to retain moisture and keep you looking glowy. Mm. Low levels of iodine affect our thyroid's influence on our metabolic rate, which again might be why you feel the cold more or gain weight. According to a study from the Journal of Hypothyroidism, over 80% of people with low thyroid hormone levels, again, commonly caused by low iodine, feel more sensitive to the cold. And this is down to the impact that low thyroid levels have on our BMR, our basal metabolic rate, which dictates how our body uses energy. A more unusual one is also loss of perspiration. So the impact that low iodine levels have on our skin also affects the rate at which we sweat. Iodine deficiency and constipation are also closely linked, according to one study I read. Plus, low libido and actually hypothyroidism can cause elevated levels of the hormone prolactin, contributing to vaginal dryness, which can make sex uncomfortable and painful. So again, as much as possible, we need to ensure our diet offers good iodine levels.
What about Anthony Williams, who has a very different viewpoint and claims to be able to heal thyroid issues?
Yes, Anthony has sold a lot of books, but it is controversial and has yet to come up with what we'd call quality data. But I still think it's worth looking at his theory. He disagrees with the autoimmune theory of thyroid issues, which is that a person's immune system becomes confused and starts attacking itself. In the case of Hashimoto's, for example, patients are told that their immune system mysteriously produces antibodies that target and damage the thyroid gland as though it were a foreign presence. Anthony disagrees with this and says that the body never attacks itself. It only goes after pathogens, usually viruses or sometimes bacteria. So he says that the antibodies released are signs that there's a virus and the immune system is putting all its energy into fighting this off, causing inflammation. He also says that by the time this virus has started to cause chronic illness, it's usually burrowed so deep into that person's organs that the virus doesn't show up on blood tests. So doctors simply label a person as having an autoimmune disease. I think it's fair to say that the thyroid gland is not as understood as some other parts of the body. There isn't much more medical insight into the thyroid than there was 100 years ago, which makes it much easier for medical communities to label thyroid conditions as autoimmune. But as I say, it's controversial.
Yeah. And he doesn't feel that it's an autoimmune issue, as you said. What does he think it is?
So again, controversially, he sees most of today's thyroid disorders, including Hashimoto's and even thyroid cancer, as being the result of Epstein-Barr virus. He also sees other thyroid problems as coming from radiation exposure due to, for example, medical x-rays or plane travel. He describes the various stages of Epstein-Barr and how they show up and talks a lot about thyroid illness being a precursor to Epstein-Barr-related neurological conditions such as chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, and multiple sclerosis. And he says that Epstein-Barr can cause either an underproduction of thyroid hormones or one particular strain of the virus can prompt the thyroid to overproduce them. Again, it's so controversial and he's only working with small self-funded study groups. So I'm not endorsing his work, but I think it's interesting to look at other views and in particular his views on blood tests.
Okay, tell us more about that.
So he says that having blood drawn can get our adrenals pumping, which completely changes our blood chemistry because suddenly adrenaline and cortisol, both steroids, flood the bloodstream in preparation for fight or flight. And these high adrenaline and cortisol levels can make it look on a blood test like we're producing enough of the thyroid-related hormones, T4, T3 and TSH, when in fact we might not be. Plus, he says adrenaline and cortisol may be saturating our brain, putting the pituitary gland, which produces this TSH hormone, into overdrive, and again, throwing off blood test results from what they'd look like normally. Likewise, if you're someone who experiences chronic stress, then you may live with constant elevated adrenaline and cortisol, for example, with adrenal fatigue. The adrenal glands produce adrenaline and cortisol erratically, sometimes flooding the bloodstream and sometimes holding back. And this is why some people get a thyroid blood test 1 week with one result and go back a week later with completely different numbers. So he says, just like with blood pressure, where we've learned to take a few readings over the course of an appointment and average them, we should take a similar approach with thyroid testing. He also says we have an issue because thyroid tests that are too broad in range and not attuned to the subtle hormonal shifts that can signal a thyroid condition. None of which is to say we should write off thyroid tests. I think, as always, this just highlights the need for personalised testing and the ability to properly interpret the results. And certainly his thoughts are interesting because stress does impact. And we know that some people find having blood tests taken very highly stressful. Personally, it doesn't bother me, but I know many people who it does.
Oh, I'm awful with them. Absolutely awful on it. And I know it's one of my most stressful things. So just to stay on this guy just for a moment, what's his solution to thyroid issues?
He's quite prescriptive. He doesn't believe in thyroid medication. He says that it works on the theory that these are designed to fill in for the thyroid hormones that a patient's body is having trouble producing or converting. But his belief is that what really happens is that the medication's mild steroid effects give patients partial relief from their low-grade viral infections, and that's all. Again, he feels the issue is the Epstein-Barr virus. So he talks about certain foods, herbs and supplements that can restore a damaged thyroid, strengthen the other glands of the endocrine system, and lower the viral load specifically within the thyroid. He also talks a lot about iodine, which he describes as a disinfectant, effective at killing both viruses and bacteria. To add balance, once again, there's no clear data here.
But from what I've read, iodine can cause an overproduction of the thyroid hormones, which you've hinted at, which the body sees as foreign invaders, which then prompts the immune system to attack the thyroid.
And here's where a lot of the confusion and controversy is. Anthony claims that when iodine reaches the thyroid, it kills off virus cells at an accelerated rate, which can in turn temporarily elevate inflammation. So too much iodine at once for someone with a high level of thyroiditis can be overwhelming because it starts killing off so many virus cells so quickly that the inflammatory response can be high. He says this inflammation is often mistaken for an autoimmune response. So he says that one of the keys for people with hypothyroidism is to avoid being completely deficient in iodine. And he mentions various sea vegetables and is quite prescriptive on diet, which is essentially a lot of healthy plant-based foods. He also talks about foods to avoid, but as there's no data around this, I'm less convinced. And he mentions various supplements from zinc to spirulina and lots of others.
All right. So he doesn't say to supplement with iodine.
No, he's actually more about a nutrient-rich, very specific diet and certain herbs and nutritional supplements.
Okay. And back to iodine. How do we know if we're deficient? Is there a test?
Yes, it can be tested through a urine sample. It's recommended that people stop taking any non-essential supplements for 48 hours before testing. And excessive fluid intake can also influence results. So I'd advise to limit your fluid intake for 24 hours before the test. If a doctor suspects low iodine, they'd likely do thyroid hormone blood tests as well.
And if we're iodine deficient, if that test shows up that we don't have as much iodine as we should do, what should we do?
In the UK, the NHS generally advises meeting our iodine needs for a balanced diet rather than routine supplementation. So again, this is milk, dairy products and fish and shellfish. We know that good sources of iodine include dairy, sea fish and shellfish. So it's the sea fish that's important here. Some cereals and grains contain iodine, but the levels vary depending on how much was in the soil where they grew. And we know our soil quality isn't what it used to be. Seaweed contains a lot of iodine and other valuable nutrients, but sourcing it is really important because it can also contain micro levels of heavy metals or other pollutants from the sea. Spirulina is really popular, and this is a kind of blue-green algae that's rich in various nutrients, including iodine. And this is where super green powders come in, like the Kiki brand, which is really good and very popular. If diet isn't working, GPs might recommend a supplement. But again, taking high doses for long periods of time could change the way your thyroid gland works and can lead to a range of different symptoms, such as weight gain. The official line is that taking 0.5 milligrams or less a day of iodine supplements is unlikely to cause harm. A lot of conventional medics say that while iodine is essential, we actually need very little of it because it's a micronutrient, and taking it excessively can actually cause hypothyroidism. And although a number of foods contain iodine, a key factor is how easily our bodies can extract it from the food, which is what we mean when we talk about bioavailability. And this can be measured in the urine. So when you eat food containing iodine, the food is digested, the iodine is extracted from it, and it enters the bloodstream. The thyroid then absorbs what it needs. Then, unless you're severely deficient in iodine, most of the iodine from that food will be converted into iodine-containing compounds, which we excrete in urine. I was really interested in a BBC experiment with Dr. Emily Combett from the University of Glasgow to compare how easily iodine could be extracted from three popular foods known to contain it, so milk, whitefish, and seaweed. It showed that milk and whitefish gave roughly the same result, with the majority extracted from the food and excreted. For seaweed, the result was significantly different, and only 50% of the dose of iodine had been extracted and excreted.
It's very interesting, particularly because I was thinking I'll get some of the seaweedy super green powders. Maybe not. Maybe it's a case of more fish, more milk. Just to sum up, what would be the best preventative lifestyle for avoiding thyroid issues if we can?
It's everything we talk about on the podcast, what we're all about. Regular exercise, good sleep, minimal stress, and a reduction in alcohol, which I'll touch on in a moment. In terms of diet, eat a protein-rich diet. So if you're vegetarian, this means a lot of eggs, milk, nuts, and beans. You want foods that are rich in not only iodine, but also selenium, zinc, and magnesium. There's actually more selenium in the thyroid than in any other part of the body, and it plays an important role in making and breaking down thyroid hormones. according to a recent review, multiple studies have suggested a link between a lack of selenium and Hashimoto's disease. You can get selenium from many foods, Brazil nuts, beans and lentils, to various meats and fish. As for zinc, the interaction between zinc and thyroid hormones is complex, and scientists are still exploring the relationship. Some evidence suggests that zinc is involved in regulating the production and activity of thyroid hormones. Levels of zinc might be linked with our levels of thyroid hormone and TSH. Common food sources of zinc are lentils, pumpkins, sesame and hemp seeds, and again, various meat and fish. Researchers are still looking into the relationship between magnesium and thyroid hormones. Again, some evidence suggests that magnesium may be involved in how your body absorbs iodine. This absorption is an important step in making thyroid hormones. Typically, our kidneys tightly control our magnesium levels, but some medications and health conditions can interfere with this process, including heavy alcohol intake. Some good sources of magnesium are pumpkin seeds, various nuts, chia seeds, spinach, black beans and lentils, and whole grains like buckwheat and quinoa as well. And we've covered the good sources of iodine. I mentioned the Kiki brand, and another good one is Dr. Seaweed's Pure Organic Seaweed, which is a natural source of iodine. So if you're concerned about either iodine deficiency or thyroid issues, I would start with all of this.
Well, thank you so much. After everything we've spoken about, I'm actually now wondering if I should get my thyroid checked, as a few of the symptoms you mentioned do feel quite familiar. And I think that's the beauty of this podcast, isn't it? You opening a few doors and getting us to think about things that perhaps we wouldn't have thought about previously. So on behalf of all of us, thank you so much, Sophie.
Thank you, Fee.
And that ends this week's podcast. If you want to find out more about me and my work, or maybe book a consultation, head to drsophieschotter.com, and you can find me on socials at drsophieschotter. And again, thank you so much for listening.